From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Bert Kearns returns to the show this week. He's the author of several fine books, including his biography of actor Lawrence Tierney, the film noir star whose career was revived by Quentin Tarantino in Reservoir Dogs. Lawrence Tierney, Hollywood's real-life tough guy. And he's also the author of the morbid but fascinating The Show Won't Go On, the most shocking, bizarre, and historic deaths of performers on stage, which he wrote with Jeff Abramson, which I thought I would hate and really love. And his new book is called Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel, a book that celebrates the great actor and coincides with the 100th anniversary of Brando's birth. Bert Kearns, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks, Gary.
Congratulations on this new book, and I really enjoyed reading it. You go off on many tangents in this book. And that's okay, you know, because I love tangents. So it's not. In fact, you say right at the beginning that it's not a biography of Marlon Brando.
No, I have sort of a reputation over the past couple of decades on doing projects about artists and figures whose names don't usually resonate with the general public. People like Neil Innes, Chris Montez, Louis Prima, Lawrence Tierney. People that when you mention their names to an editor or a television entity, they'll say, who? And so it came time to do something, a book about a figure that people have heard of. And when the name Marlon Brando came up, it was like, okay, that's a great idea. But there's been so much written about Marlon Brando, you know, 800-page books. There's books by Peter Mansell and William J. Mann, Patricia Bosworth. Brando himself had a couple of books out. What else could be done for his 100th, you know, anniversary? So I started with, you know, the Brando that I was familiar with. I'm into pop culture, and I'm into going down rabbit holes and going off on tangents, but I'm not necessarily a cinephile. I'm not an expert in cinema like some other writers are. But I always would start with that image of Brando on the motorcycle in The Wild One. I was familiar with that as a kid. I remember the poster. I had that poster, that black and white poster, along with the poster of, you know, Peter Fonda as Captain America on the motorcycle with the red, white, and blue gas tank, which I painted in myself and colored it in when I was a kid. And I was involved in the punk rock scene in the 70s and Punk magazine. I know that the first issue of Punk, that it was dedicated to Marlon Brando, the original punk. So I started going down the rabbit holes and used Brando's biography as a jumping off point to elements of popular culture that he influenced and continues to influence 100 years after his birth and 20 years after his death.
Well, when I first got my first driver's license in those days in California, if you were under, 18 or 21 or whatever, there was a black and white profile picture on your driver's license. And there was an article in Time magazine about Marlon Brando because The Godfather had just come out. And there was this picture of him in The Wild One with his hat on in an exact profile that was exactly the size of my driver's license picture. So I cut it out and I taped it over my own picture on my driver's license. So I had Brando's picture on my driver's license. And sure enough, I got stopped by a cop, but he just looked at it and
he understood.
I don't know. Maybe I looked enough like Brando that he didn't. So I guess if people were going to ask me, you know, what is the most iconic role of Brando's, you know, I would think, well, Terry Molloy in On the Waterfront, or Stanley Kowalski in Streetcar Named Desire, or Don Vito Corleone in The Godfather. But you really focus a lot of this book on The Wild One.
Yes. The Wild One was Brando's fourth motion picture. It was a picture that he made. He had done The Men. He'd come to Hollywood and played a paraplegic war veteran in The Men, a message movie that was produced by Stanley Kramer, who did those sort of socially relevant films. Then he went on to Viva Zapata, where he played the Mexican revolutionary. He recreated his role as Stanley Kowalski in Streetcar. Then, you know, the actor that was known as the mumbler and the slob did Shakespeare. He played Mark Antony in Julius Caesar and as I say, you know, killed doing
Yeah,
that.
he was great.
He had been nominated, I believe, by then for three Academy Awards. By the time the award season came around for Julius Caesar, what's his next step? Well, he's going to make a biker flick. And but at the time, it wasn't a biker flick. You know, The Wild One was another Stanley Kramer picture that was going to be a socially relevant motion picture that explained why these men who came back from World War II couldn't fit back into society, why they were rebelling against these Eisenhower years that were about to get underway. Also attacking the issue of juvenile delinquency, which had become a problem in the boom after World War II. So he had a lot of issues he wanted to bring out. He wanted to bring out the reasons behind it, and also to make it very clear that the so-called straight folks in middle America were just as to blame for these people rebelling as were the rebels themselves. And it wasn't directed toward kids. This was a movie that was directed toward adults. They didn't have a youth market then. Well,
Sure.
something happened with this film. You know, it had a lot to do with Brando's choice in the way he played the character. Here he is, a 28-year-old man playing the leader of a motorcycle gang as if he was a mincing 15-year-old bisexual who's afraid of girls, which is what I came away from watching it.
Yeah.
And that had a real impact on the Hollywood leading man, how that changed. It went from people like Gary Cooper and Clark Gable to people like James Dean and people who were a lot softer, you know, and Elvis, you know, people that were like adolescents, you know, no matter how old you were as a Hollywood hero, you were an adolescent, thanks to Marlon Brando. It also kicked off a rock and roll revolution, even though there wasn't a note of rock and roll in the film. And it
Sure.
happened to come out around the time that Brown versus Board of Education ruling came out from the Supreme Court. Civil rights movement was just starting, and this fed into that as well. Marlon Brando, the Black Rebels Motorcycle Club, speaking this jazz lingo, this black lingo that was well known in the 1940s, et cetera. That's where I start going off on tangents and start following these tangents and seeing where it leads. And it all leads to the Village People.
The village people, yeah, of course.
All roads.
I love all the tangents, but let me ask you this about The Wild One and the homosexual, bisexual subtext that you see in the film, which you spend quite a bit of time talking about in Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel, Burt Kearns. When young people today see old Hollywood films, they often see things that they find offensive that were not intended to be offensive when they were put into the film. These usually involve racism or sexism of some kind. And I guess if you see them, they're there. But of course, the people making the films had no idea that they were offending anyone. All the offense was retroactive or unintentional. Do you think it goes the other way? Do you think that you can see subtext in a film? And I guess if you see it, it's there. But does that mean that the people who made the film had any intention of including that subtext?
I found it to be text in The Wild One, as other people have as well.
Okay.
When Marlon Brando, and you could see it in the reviews at the time, you know, Bosley Crowther in the New York Times is saying, you know, I really felt something was missing when Lee Marvin left the movie and it was taken over by this nice little girl, because their passion really wasn't as heavy as it was between Marvin and Brando's character. What goes on is, Brando and his group, the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, show up in this town. They take over the town. They kind of go wild, and then another motorcycle group comes in, led by Lee Marvin. He and Brando have a past. They used to ride together. The first thing that Lee Marvin says when he sees Brando is, "I missed you, Johnny. I love you. I love you, Johnny. I love you." And then they wrestle. And you know, "I love you," and they wrestle some more, just like Oliver Reed and Alan Bates wrestled in Women in Love.
Well, I
They
don't
had
know
their
if it's
leather
quite
on.
the
And
same. Yeah.
also, I think it was also the way that Brando chose to play this character. We talk about, you know, Brando. One of the great things about him in all of the roles he does is the way he plays a character, unlike the way you might expect him to. If he's in Sayonara, He's playing an army officer in Korea. And in the book, he's a hard-bitten, you know, tough officer. The way Brando plays him is like an everyman, you know, a gentle character. The way he played Fletcher Christian in Mutiny on the Bounty, as you know. In this role, he's playing the boss of a motorcycle gang, and he chooses to have a high-pitched, lisping voice, which when you go into the background of the film, you find out that the reason he used it is because the censors forced him to give a spoken prelude to the film, which sort of went against everything Brando wanted in the film. He said, this is something that could never happen anywhere else. It only happened here. When Brando said, no, this could happen anywhere in America, this sort of takeover, these rebels. And he put on a voice, according to his director, so no one would think that it was really Brando saying it. Well, he kept that voice through the whole film. And then you look into it a bit more, and you find out that in wanting to tackle juvenile delinquency, I went into like the juvenile delinquency commissions of Congress, et cetera. And one thing they were very concerned about was homosexuality among these juvenile delinquent gang members. For the first time, they weren't worried about, you know, these strange men grabbing kids. Kids were doing it together. And that's mentioned a lot in reviews of The Wild Ones. So I just kind of went where the rabbit hole led.
Well, there was a book written around that time called Seduction of the Innocent by a guy named Dr. Frederick Wertheim, mm-hmm. in which he claimed that juvenile delinquency was the result of comic books. And he also cites homosexuality as a scourge that can be traced to comic books. And he cites particularly Batman and Robin. Why does Batman want to have this 12-year-old boy in his underpants running around with him all the time?
There you go.
But of course, we know that the reason that Batman had Robin is because the comic book publishers knew that there were a lot of kids reading the books, and so they wanted to have a character that the kids could associate with, and they had no intention of putting in any homosexual text or subtext at all. It's being read in by a purient guy who's probably obsessed with it himself. When people look at the movie Red River, are you familiar with Red River? It's a Howard Hawks film that stars John Wayne and Montgomery Clift. And Montgomery Clift is a young gunslinger who has a sort of a rivalry with another young gunslinger in the movie, and they show each other their guns. And when you see this movie with a contemporary audience, everybody laughs because it's hilariously funny. And I'm sure that Howard Hawks knew that it was funny when he put it in there. But I don't think the audiences at the time thought that it was a particularly hilarious scene.
Right.
You know, in other words, it's a little bit more a retroactive kind of, you know, they were doing an in-joke, but it wasn't what the purpose of the film was about. The movie is a Western about John Wayne Western. So, again, I'm not sure that the Wild One, I mean, isn't its intent as an exciting adventure picture about a motorcycle gang, not so much about the sexual orientation of the character?
Well, I could just add again, I made it clear in the book that this was the queer interpretation of the film. It is one interpretation of the film.
Yeah.
While making the film, and interestingly enough, the film did inspire, you know, the rise in the number of motorcycle gangs like the Hells Angels, et cetera.
Yeah, that's true.
But they all took their cue sartorially and attitude-wise from Lee Marvin's gang, who dressed in, you know, thrift shop clothes and army surplus clothes. Brando's group were very fussy men in leather jackets and nice jeans that are rolled up. And the real-life motorcycle gang members, the real-life cyclists who were used as extras in the film, made fun of them and said, oh, look at those little pansies. Look at the way they're all dressed, how fussy they are. And Lee Marvin teased Brando a bit about it as well. So it's there. But again, that's only part of the influence of The Wild One. We go on from there to influence of the career of Elvis Presley.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Elvis, because, of course, when Elvis did his famous comeback special when he was only 32 years old, he's wearing that leather outfit, leather pants, leather jacket, which he didn't wear again after that, I think because it was too hard to perform in something so hot. So that's when he went to the crazy jumpsuits, which now everyone's wearing.
Right.
As jumpsuits were really kind of nuts. But what do you think is the influence of Brando, who is what? Brando was born in 24, is that right?
24, yeah.
And Presley in 35, so 11 years later. What do you think is the influence on Presley?
Well, again, looking back on Elvis's career, you find out that when the Wild One was released, it was banned in Memphis. It was banned in Memphis the year that Elvis graduated from high school. And he was driving a truck and he was interested in becoming an actor. And the movie was banned in Memphis, but it was not banned across the Mississippi River in West Memphis, Arkansas. So they were advertising that, saying, come see it here. It's banned in Memphis. And it was obviously a film that affected Elvis Presley's image. And again, going down these tangents and rabbit holes, I find an interview from 1955 with Lloyd Shearer, who later was famous from Parade magazine. He's interviewing young Elvis before he has hit it big. He's in the Peabody Hotel in Memphis in a room, and he's talking to Elvis, and Elvis is very respectful and saying, calling him sir, et cetera, because Shearer was a bit older. And Shearer takes out his camera to take a picture. And Elvis says, oh, hold. Please, sir, you cannot take a picture of me when I'm smiling, because you know Marlon Brando, you know, knows you've got to be a rebel. You can't smile in a picture. I find this in one of the first articles about Elvis. And then Elvis made it very clear that it was a much bigger deal for him to get an acting contract than it was to get a music contract. One of his famous quotes was, you know, you can be a singer and be a star, but if you really want to be a star and be lasting, you have to be an actor. When he got his first movie contract, it was the same week it was announced, I believe, that, you know, Heartbreak Hotel won its gold record. And he was being interviewed on the radio in Texas, and he said, oh, that's great that I got the gold record, but I just signed a contract with Paramount Pictures, and I'm going to make movies, and I'm not going to sing in any of my movies. I'm going to go to New York and go to the Actor's Studio. I'm going to be like Marlon Brando, and I'm going to be an actor. Well, his manager, Colonel Parker, changed that a bit. That's also mentioned in this new film, Priscilla. There's a scene in Priscilla where they're watching on the waterfront, and he says to her, you know, hey, I want to be like Marlon Brando. And that was Elvis's goal. And again, tracing Elvis's films and the critical reaction to his films up until the time he went into the army kept getting closer and closer. First, he was like a little kid in Love Me Tender. And then he did Jailhouse Rock, and he was getting a little bit of respect here and there. And by the time he made it to King Creole, they were saying, this guy can act. He's not bad. And interestingly enough, King Creole was a film that had originally been written for James Dean. It had a different name. It was set in Brooklyn. When James Dean died, they rewrote it, set it in New Orleans, added some songs, and gave it to Elvis. While he's making King Creole, Elvis is drafted. And rather than ask for a deferment or ask for any sort of, you know, they were offering him. They said, look, you don't really have to join the army. You could do some shows for us. I was like, no, our boy Elvis is going to go in the army. He said, just give us an extra month so we can finish this film, King Creole. And then he went over to the army. When he came back, the critic said, well, something happened to this guy, Elvis, because, you know, he's clean cut now, and he sure isn't as dangerous like he used to be.
Right. I mean, I think he made a career move right there because his first appearance after he comes back from the army is appearance on the Frank Sinatra show. And Frank Sinatra hated rock and roll, of course. So I think it really did make a statement, you know, when he came back.
Well,
But
speaking of Sinatra, just real quick, when Elvis did come back, they made a couple of attempts at giving him some serious films that didn't have music in it. And one of them, I believe, was the movie Flaming Star, where he played a, quote, you know, half-breed. And that was a film that had originally been written for Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra to play brothers. And they were too old for it, and Elvis got the role, and he didn't get the praise that he was hoping for.
I like that picture, but I think the colonel, if I remember my Elvis lore, said to him, "Look how much less money this movie made than this other movie. So your audience doesn't want to see you in this; they want to see you in this." And Colonel Parker was much more interested in finance than in art. And that's kind of the direction that Elvis's career went. I mean, he made a couple of other attempts at acting, but as you and I have talked about, I don't think he was as good an actor after his stint in the army, because that's when he became reliant on pills.
On pills,
And I think he lost his acting chops to a certain degree. And also he was a creature of habit and he was very lazy. So, he'd make a movie, then he'd do a soundtrack album. And then when he stopped making movies, he did a concert and then a concert album. He very rarely went into the recording studio. There's very, it's a, it, 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 this is something I talked with Patricia Bosworth about, who wrote a book about Marlon Brando. Brando, I think, is kind of lazy too. And I asked her, why are there so few great Brando films when there should be so many? And she said, I look at it the other way. Isn't it amazing how many great Marlon Brando films there are, considering how many terrible ones there are?
Well, it was funny. Speaking of that, I looked up, Robert De Niro was 80 years old. Brando died at 80. And I looked them up on IMDb. And among the acting credits, De Niro has 135. Brando, 48. A couple of them are after his death, some, voiceover things. So he didn't take a lot of movie roles. And when he did, he was often doing it to fund his projects or his ex-wives or whatever, but he was doing it because he needed the money. When I came into this project, again, there were a lot of Marlon Brando films I had never seen, and it was a real voyage of discovery for me, especially when I hear about the '60s being Brando's lost decade of films, where he really gave over most of his time to his activism, and if he was going to make a movie, it had to be related to that. And found that, some of his best work was in the '60s, and he never phoned in a performance in any of it. And some of the stuff I think is some of his best work.
I agree, and he does make some really interesting choices. You were talking about Mutiny on the Bounty earlier, which is a movie he spent, I think, probably a year or more making. And his interpretation of Fletcher Christian, I think it fits in with the realism that we associate with Marlon Brando as an actor, especially since the film had won an Academy Award for Best Picture in 1934, if I'm not mistaken, with Clark Gable in the role of Fletcher Christian, and Gable plays him, and much of the dialogue is the same. Gable plays him as a real, adventuresome, he-man. And Brando, as you said, kind of plays him as this foppish, with this peculiar accent that he. But he seems like a much, I think he. Well, I just watched it, not maybe a year ago, and I was struck by, I really believe him. Whereas you don't really believe Clark Gable. I mean, you enjoy the picture a lot, but I think it's probably a more enjoyable picture than the remake. But there are lots of things to find wonderful in that remake, and I think the choice that Brando makes for his character is one of them.
He does. His characters always have this humanity and this realism that everybody else in the scene, as you had mentioned once, everybody else in the scene is acting, and he's not. It's funny, if I could just go on another tangent, a film that I sort of discovered from the '60s, from 1964, Bedtime Story. So he plays in Bedtime Story, this gigolo from the army in Europe, who hooks up with David Niven, who is this man who's able to exploit women on the Riviera, and he takes lessons from David Niven, and then becomes his competition. Well, anyway, it's a comedy, and it's co-written by Paul Henning, who created the Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres, so you can't go wrong there. And it is a comic, wild Jerry Lewis type performance by Marlon Brando. And when the film came out, again, I watched it and I was amazed. I'm saying Brando is crazy in this. He's so funny. Then I look at the reviews and I see that, the New York Times says Brando knows how to surprise us, and he really surprises us in this. And it's a ring-a-ding role, and he is funny, and it works. He did it. It works. Then I find out, I sort of, well, I guess I didn't know this, that the movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is based on this.
Yeah, it's a remake.
So I started watching Dirty Rotten Scoundrels just recently, and I'm saying, wait, this is really similar to the Brando film. So I started going back and forth between scenes. The dialogue and the scenes are almost exact in many places, except they've added, it's from the late 1980s. Steve Martin and Michael Caine are in it. They add some Steve Martin humor and bathroom humor, et cetera, for the 1980s. And I'm watching it, and I was amazed at how much of a ripoff this movie was. It wasn't, you know, this shot by for shot in some of the comedy was the same as Brando's film. And Brando's film was better. It was timeless, while in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, they're making Danny Terrio jokes, you know, from Dance Fever. It was very much of its time. Then I do a little more, and I go down the rabbit hole a bit more, and I realize that Frank Oz was the director.
Yeah. The Frank
and
Oz.
Frank Oz from The Muppets, et cetera. Frank Oz did very well in comedies through the 90s until he decided to make a serious crime film. And it was called The Score. And it was about three generations of criminals. Edward Norton, Robert De Niro, and Marlon Brando. And Marlon Brando gave Frank Oz such a hard time, called him Miss Piggy, wouldn't work with him. They had to keep him outside and let De Niro come in and translate the direction to Brando. And I think it was because of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Interesting. That's a good theory.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of remakes, so I think that's probably, you know, I agree with you for sure that the original is generally better. Although, and this is true with Meeting on the Bounty as well. I think the original was better. I think the funniest movie, I mean, if you talk about Brando as a comedian, and the most surprisingly funny role he ever played is The Freshman.
Yeah.
That is hilarious. Yeah. He's really funny in it. And he's funny because he plays it completely straight.
And people, again, discovered Brando. You see him being rediscovered in the 90s going, we never knew Marlon Brando was funny like this. And he was. He was very funny off camera. He was very funny with the actors that he worked with, et cetera. And yeah, that was another revelation to a lot of people.
There's a scene where Matthew Broderick is asking Brando, who's playing his godfather character, why he has a picture of Benito Mussolini on the wall. And Brando says, oh, for me, it's like, you know, like the Beatles. And the Beatles is another tangent that you get off on in your book, Burt Kearns, Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel. Well, of course, when the Beatles first had their first pictures made by Ashton Kutcher, they're all dressed in their Wild One leather outfits, which apparently was also the thing that attracted the interest of Brian Epstein originally to be their manager, who then immediately took them out of those suits and put them in suits.
Yeah. Well, it also came down to where did the name the Beatles come from? And again, here's the tangent and here's the rabbit hole. When it first came out, John Lennon, of course, said, it came to me, you know, a dream. A man came down with a flaming pie and said, you shall be Beatles with an A. And the idea was, you know, Buddy Holly and the Crickets, they wanted to do something similar. They came up with the idea of Beatles with a EA for the beat rather than the insect. It was a word play, et cetera. And they thought that was great. Then come along in the 1970s, George Harrison is doing an interview and he mentions the fact that, well, you know, the reason we were called the Beatles was because Stu Sutcliffe, one of the original members of the group, was really into this movie, The Wild One. And there's a scene at the beginning of the film when Lee Marvin's group shows up and he's telling Johnny how much he loves him and how much he misses him. He says, you know, we missed you. We all missed you. The Beatles missed you. And the Beatles were the name of the groupies, the girls that were riding. The Black Rebel Motorcycle, Brando's group, did not have any girls with them. Lee Marvin's group had a contingent of old ladies, I guess. And so there's that reading again. Sorry.
More evidence.
Yeah. And so he was the first to say that. Then you look into it again, and it turned out all along, Stu Sutcliffe's sister, who had written a couple of books, had them ghost written for her, had said the same thing, that's where it came from, that they were really into Marlon Brando and The Wild One. So then you talk to the Beatle experts, and there's some real Beatle authorities out there, and they're saying there's no possible way this could have happened because The Wild One was banned in Britain until 1968. Because again, they were afraid that it was going to inspire youth violence, et cetera, and gangs. But then again, I look into it and you find out that it was banned, but it really wasn't banned. Cinema clubs were allowed to have showings. It was in every movie magazine. That image that I talked about of Brando on the motorcycle as Johnny Strabler was everywhere in Europe. And, you know, it was written about, everybody knew it. And so as you, in the 70s and 80s, as more Beatle books were written, this was mentioned. When it came down to that Beatles anthology documentary, They take Lennon's original quote from 1964, where he says, "A man with a flaming pie says, 'You will be the Beatles.'" And then it cuts without comment to the scene where Lee Marvin in The Wild One says, "Hey, Johnny, the Beatles missed you." And then it fades to black from there. Paul McCartney later said that the reason they did that was because all of the Beatles, when it came down to the anthology and anything in Beatle history, they all had to agree on what the story was going to be. And Yoko Ono had an equal vote to the other Beatles, and she really believed that John Lennon had gotten the name from A Man with a Flaming Pie. And she wanted that out there. I also bring it back to the cover of Sergeant Pepper, where they're in a crowd scene with cutouts of lots of celebrities and historic figures, and standing next to the Beatles themselves are the four Beatles statues from Madame Tussauds, and behind them, overlooking their shoulder, is a picture of Marlon Brando as John Strabler from The Wild One. I shouldn't be giving away so much, but yeah.
Well, there's a lot happening in your book, Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel, and lots of other tangents that I really enjoyed.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking this week with Bert Kearns. He's the author of Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel. This month marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Marlon Brando, and let's take a moment and listen to Brando in some of his greatest roles. Let's begin with the film On the Waterfront, in which he played boxer Terry Molloy. And in this famous scene, he's riding in a car with his brother, played by Rod Steiger. The film was written by Bud Schulberg and directed by Ilya Kazan.
I'm glad you stopped by for me. I've been wanting to talk to you.
Yeah, sure, kid.
Where to?
You just go to River Street and I'll tell you where to stop.
I thought we was going to the garden.
We are, but I want to cover a bed on the way over. Besides, this will give us a chance to talk.
Well, nobody ever stopped you from talking, Charlie.
Listen, the grapevine says that you got a subpoena.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the guys would know you well enough to know that you're not a cheese eater, but they think maybe you should not be on the outside so much, a little on the inside, have a few little things working for you down at the docks.
A steady job, a couple extra potatoes, that's all I want.
Oh, sure, that's great when you're a kid, but you're getting on, you're pushing 30, Slugger. You know, it's time to think about getting some ambition.
I always figured I'd live a little bit longer without it.
Maybe. Look, there's a boss loader slot that's open on the new pier we're opening up. You see, now, it pays 6 cents on every 100 pounds that goes in and every 100 pounds that goes out, and you don't have to lift a finger. That's $400 a week. $400 a week, just for the openers.
I get all that dough for not doing nothing.
You don't do anything, and you don't say anything. You understand?
There's more to this than I thought, Charlie. I'm telling you, there's a lot more.
You don't mean that you're thinking of testifying against some people that we might know?
I don't know, Charlie. I mean, I'm telling you, I don't know, Charlie. That's what I want to talk to you about.
Listen, Terry, you know how much those piers are worth that we control through the local?
I know that.
All right, you think that Johnny's going to jeopardize the whole setup for one rubber-lipped ex-tanker
don't
who's walking
that
on his heels? What the?
Been better.
That's not the point.
I could have been a lot better,
the
Charlie.
The point is we don't have much time.
I'm telling you, I haven't made up my mind
yet.
Well,
make up your mind before we get to 437 River Street.
Before we get to where, Charlie? Before we get to where...
Listen to me, Terry. Take the job. Just take it. No questions. Take it. Terry, take this job, please.
Charlie.
Please take it.
Charlie. Oh, Charlie. Wow. time. Look, kid. How much you waste, then? And you weighed 168 pounds. You were beautiful. You could have been another Billy Kahn. That skunk we got you for the manager, he brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. Remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
Okay. Okay. I tell him I couldn't find you. 10-1, he won't believe me. Here. You take this. You're gonna need it. You pull over!
Marlon Brando from On the Waterfront, for which Marlon Brando was awarded an Academy Award, his first of two. His second Oscar he won in 1972 for playing Don Vito Corleone in The Godfather. And here is a scene from that film, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. Featured in this scene is Al Pacino in the role of Michael Corleone.
So, Barzini will move against you first. He'll set up a meeting with someone that you absolutely trust, guaranteeing your safety. And at that meeting, you'll be assassinated. I like to drink wine more than I used to. Anyway, I'm drinking more.
It's good for you, Pop.
I don't know. Your wife and children, are you happy with them?
Very happy.
That's good. I hope you don't mind the way I keep going over this Pacini business.
No, not at all.
It's an old habit. I spend my life trying not to be careless. Women and children can be careless, but not men. How's your boy?
He's good.
You know, he looks more like you every day.
He's smarter than I am. 3 years old, he can read the funny papers.
Read the funny papers. I want you to arrange to have a telephone man check all the calls that go over.
I did it already, Pop.
Good man.
Pop, I took care of that.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
What's the matter? What's bothering you? I'll handle it. I told you I can handle it. I'll handle it.
I knew that Santino was going to have to go through all this. And Fredo... Fredo was... And I never wanted this for you. I worked my whole life. I don't apologize to take care of my family. And I refused to be a fool. Dancing on a string held by all those big shots. I don't apologize, that's my life, but I thought that... But when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the strings. Senator Corleone. Governor Corleone. Something.
Another peso novanta.
This wasn't enough time, Michael. Wasn't enough time.
We'll get there, Pop. We'll get there.
Now listen, whoever comes to you with a Sparzini meeting, he's the traitor. Don't forget that.
Marlon Brando and Al Pacino from The Godfather. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Let's get back to our interview with Burt Kearns, author of Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel.
And I know you talked to a lot of brilliant people when you were making this book. In fact, I think it's fair to say I am the co-author of this book.
You could yes, say. You are. Yes, you are. You've got some great stuff, and I thank you for that. I have to talk to the cinema experts because I'm not an expert at it. So I talk to the people who are in the know.
Well, thank you for including me in the book. I was very flattered to be in it. But who else did you talk to?
I talked to, you know, to some critics. I talked to Larry Karaszewski, who is the screenwriter and producer. He wrote Ed Wood. They did The People versus Larry Flint. He worked with Johnny Depp in Ed Wood, and he got to watch Brando and Depp worked together when they did Don Juan DeMarco, et cetera. He's a former vice president of the Academy. So he spoke, he was able to speak a bit about Sasheen Littlefeather
And
what went on at the Oscars then and the Academy's recent, you know, apology that they had given her. Other film critics. An interesting one was Michael Madsen. The actor who I had spoken to Michael, he helped me a lot with the Lawrence Tierney book because he was in Reservoir Dogs and loved Lawrence Tierney.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk to Michael about Brando's influence on motorcycle films because Madsen was in one of the last, you know, wild ones. It was called Hell Ride. Larry Bishop, who was Joey Bishop's son, who starred in a lot of the Roger Corman type films in the 1960s. Starred in and directed this. It was a throwback to those old 1960s biker films with a lot more sex and violence in it. And Quentin Tarantino executive produced it and re-edited it for release. So I want to talk to Madsen about that. And then I realized that I found out Madsen was actually in Brando's last film appearance, which was a Michael Jackson video called You Rock My World, where Brando played a Godfather type character and Madsen played a sort of a mob type figure. Then I find out that Madsen and Christian Brando, Brando's son, were best friends early on when he came out to Hollywood, when Madsen first came out to Hollywood, and they had a welding business together. So he always knew Brando was Christian's dad. From him, I got some insight into Brando's as a person and as a father.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. You do a great job with your books in creating a mood. In fact, I was talking earlier in your introduction about your book about celebrities that have died on stage, and I when I first got that book in the mail, I said, "Well, I don't want to read this. I don't want to do this book. This looks like something that's sensationalistic and not up my alley." So then I opened it and started reading it, and realized that what a great book it is, and how you really felt. You and your partner who wrote the book, Jeff Abram, you really got into the people that you talked about. You showed them a great deal of respect and honor when you talked about them. And that was one of the things that I love about your writing. And you certainly did that here and with your book about Lawrence Tierney as well. And now you're working on a book about Shem Howard. Is this right?
Right. Where do you go after Marlon Brando, but to Shem Howard? when I started the book, it was the idea was that there have been lots of books on the Three Stooges. There's been books on Moe. There have been books, several books on Larry Fine. Curly's got books. There never had been a book, a real biography of Shemp Howard. So I got to work on that. Again, this is a different point of view. I'm not one of the Three Stooges, you know, fanboys who go yuck, 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 and into all that. I dug the Three Stooges. I when I was a kid, I watched them growing up outside of New York. Officer Joe Bolton on Channel 11 would throw the Stooges every day. My mother would not want us to watch them because they were too violent. So, of course, we wanted to watch them more. But I grew out of the Three Stooges. And I kind of found that, you know, Curly is beloved by everyone. He was a force of nature. He was a Bellucci, you know, Chris Farley, Fatty Arbuckle type character with the same appetites. Shemp was a very gifted actor and a very gifted film comedian, more of an everyman type. And the cult around Curly is, you know, a lot of bro culture and rah-rah. Cult around Shemp is a little darker and a little more cynical. And it's the people that grew up past the 60s, you know, through Watergate and punk and disco and the cynicism of that era. You dig Shemp. So I found out a lot of interesting things about Shemp and his life and his relationship with his brothers and his fans, et cetera. So, it's a pretty cool book, I think.
So October. I can expect some tangents in your Shemp book.
The Shemp book is more of a biography. Okay. Fewer tangents.
Fewer, but not none.
Yeah, there are rabbit holes. I follow them and see where they lead. And there's some of them are quite interesting, I think, yeah.
Well, the thing that I think is wonderful about Shemp Howard is that unlike Curly Howard or Mo Howard, he had a long career outside of the Three Stooges. He not only made shorts on his own, but he also appears in some of my favorite movies like The Bank Dick with W.C. Fields.
He did have some great roles. The thing with Shemp was they were able to pop him into these films for a scene or two, which may not have had anything to do directly with the plot, but always fit in and, you know, were often bright spots of these films. You know, he was in films with John Wayne, Randolph Scott, and Marlene Dietrich, the film Pittsburgh. Great role in that.
Picture. Mm-hmm.
He was in Another Thin Man, shows up at the end of the film and steals the film. And some of his best work is in Damon Runyon-type films, including one with Abbott Costello.
It Ain't Hate. Right, that's right. You never know when he's going to show up because he works a lot.
Yeah, and he was good, and he wanted to work, yeah.
One of the things I find fascinating about the Three Stooges, especially given the fact that in the 21st century, all of their work is available on Blu-ray. People are still demanding Three Stooges. They just went to work every day. They didn't even know if they would be renewed for the following season. They didn't know they were stars. They just went to work, and they did their thing.
Never asked for a raise. You know, Mo was the financial wizard, never asked for a raise for all those years.
I was in the Shermart Market on Santa Monica and Robertson in 1970 something, and I was with my girlfriend and I saw Mo Howard buying a grapefruit standing in line. Little guy. I said, "That's Mo Howard." And my friend said, "Who's Mo Howard?" I said, "Oh, come on." And I went over there. I said, "Aren't you Mo Howard?" He goes, "Yeah, you want my autograph?" And he had a huge stack of Three Stooges pictures in his coat, which he then everybody gathered around.
That's so great. It's funny mentioning that who's Mo Howard. Just getting back to Brando, I was lucky enough. I've done a lot of documentaries. I've produced and directed documentaries. The one feature film that I worked on was a film called Cloud Nine that starred Burt Reynolds as the coach of an all stripper beach volleyball team. I apologize for that.
But it was a great work of art. I'm sorry I missed that one.
Well, it was written by myself, my production partner at the time, Brett Hudson, who came from the Hudson Brothers back in the 70s.
Oh, the Hudson Brothers. Sure, they were funny.
And the third person who was our co-writer was Al Ruddy.
And
Al was, of course, won the Oscar for producing The Godfather. Mm. So Brett, Al, and I wrote and produced this movie, Cloud Nine. And the executive producer was Gray Fredrickson. Gray was an assistant producer on The Godfather and won the Academy Award for producing Godfather Part Two.
Hmm.
And so I got to work with these guys, and Gray returned to Oklahoma. He was a good old boy from Oklahoma City. He returned to Oklahoma and retired there, started a film department at the local community college, got these kids making films, working on actual films, and he would lecture them. And I kept in touch with Gray. He was a great, great guy. And I quoted him in the book, and I was interviewing for the book, and I said, you know, what, when you're in class and you talk about working with Marlon Brando, because Gray worked on Candy with Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
He worked on Apocalypse Now with Brando. And so he knew the guy. He would get phone calls from Brando. Just thought he was a nice enough, you know, interesting, quirky guy. I said, what's it like? And he goes, most of the kids never heard of Marlon Brando in the class. He goes, maybe a third of them have heard of The Godfather. And that's where everybody knows the Three Stooges. But again, my kids don't know from Marlon Brando.
But they know the Three Stooges.
and that's where, you know, you want people to know that, you know, the kids today, I think, and I hate to say kids today, but they, you know, they know so much, I'm going to yell at a cloud, but they know so much more. They have so much more information than we ever had. They're so much more intelligent, but it seems that history began with them sometime in this century. And again, it's always, you know, again, going down these rabbit holes and bringing this history to life today, where you say, oh, well, you see that outfit that your favorite, you know, punk musician is performing. You know where that came from.
Well,
no, really, who's Marlon Brando?
You also talk about Brando's influence in pop art.
That again, that goes back to the image of Johnny Strabler from the Wild One. That image, of course, was one of the images that Andy Warhol kept close to him. And when Andy Warhol first got into his Hollywood pop art, Brando was one of those original characters and pictures that he used. Also, there's an artist by the name of Tom of Finland. Tom of Finland is known for transforming the, quote, stereotypical image of the homosexual from the, you know, the effeminate, you know, pansy type image to the macho guy in the leather jacket, bulging with muscles, the leather man from The Village People, we talk about. He got that image from seeing The Wild One, and Marlon Brando was the person who was behind that. And Brando's image influenced Kenneth Anger, the underground filmmaker, who was a great influence on Martin Scorsese and people like that. He got a little mention in the Academy Awards this year, I think, when they were doing the In Memoriam section, when it went to just that scroll of, or that wall of little names. His name was the first, I guess, because alphabetically it was. But Kenneth Anger was very influenced by Brando. Tried to buy Brando's leather jacket at an auction, one of his friends told me. I think he got the hat, but he never was able to get the leather jacket. So, artistically.
Robert Mapplethorpe, you also mentioned Robert Mapplethorpe.
And Robert Mapplethorpe, of course, yeah. I mean, that image of Brando, the shot perfecto leather jacket, you know, became an iconic image in punk music, punk rock. The Ramones, the Dictators, wore those jackets. The Ramones really turned it into an art piece. They were sort of more of an art project than they would admit. And that was all connected to the, you know, Mapplethorpe, Patti Smith, Andy Warhol, all that group in the 70s, around the time that Tom of Finland, that artist, came over to America for the first time. And Mapplethorpe hosted his first gallery exhibition in New York.
Well, it's all really fascinating. And like I said, I enjoy every rabbit hole that we go down in Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel, and the author, my guest, Bert Kearns. Bert, congratulations on the new book, and happy birthday, Marlon Brando, and I can't wait to talk to you about Shemp Howard.
All right, thanks very much, and everybody read the book, to read what you said. You've got some great stuff in it. Thank you so much.
Bert Kearns is the author of Lawrence Tierney, Hollywood's Real Life Tough Guy, and The Show Won't Go On, The Most Shocking, Bizarre, and Historic Deaths of Performers on Stage. His brand new book is Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel, and his forthcoming book, Shemp, the biography of the Three Stooges, Shemp Howard, the face of film comedy. Before we go, let's listen to Marlon Brando from the 1953 production of Julius Caesar, in which he plays Mark Anthony.
Hear me! I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it was so, it was a grievous fault. And grievously hath Caesar answered it. Here under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man. So are they all honorable men. Come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. He hath brought many captives home to Rome whose ransoms did the general coffers fill. Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? When did the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept? Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. You all did see that on the Lupercal I thrice presented him a kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and sure he is an honorable man. I speak not to disprove what Brutus spoke, but here I am to speak what I do know. You all did love him once, not without cause. What cause withholds you then to mourn for him? Oh, judgment, thou art led to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Bear with me, my heart is in the coffin there with Caesar, and I must pause till it come back to me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.